This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
I'm against it. You already have mismanaged the economy, mismanaged the value of the currency. There's hardship, there's hunger, there's deprivation.
That was Adekola Lijogi, one of the Nigerians taking part in a nationwide demonstration today to protest economic hardships. Details coming up. Also, an analyst predicts that Ethiopia's economy recovery package will likely be painful for the average citizen. And Russia, the United States, and five other countries are reportedly exchanging 26 prisoners today. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Nigerian police fired tear gas at protesters in the capital Abuja and the northern city of Kano as thousands of people took to the streets across the country to protest economic hardships. Our reporter in Abuja, Nigeria, has more.
It's day one of planned protests in Nigeria, and demonstrators are out in cities around the country. Protesters gathered as early as 6 in the morning, chanting solidarity songs and waving placards and banners. There are reports of a heavy presence of armed security forces, as officials have expressed concern over the violence that plagued recent economic protests in Kenya. In Abuja, rights activist Felix Ashimole tells VOA the protest so far has been peaceful at the Moshood Abiola Stadium, known as National Stadium.
So far, there's no confrontation. The police are by the side. But at the end of that road that leads to National Hospital, police are trying to block the procession. So they are insisting that they should be confined to the stadium and not to walk the street. So we are suspecting that there may be a showdown.
The End Bad Governance in Nigeria movement began online to protest worsening economic conditions such as soaring inflation and high unemployment. The protesters also oppose government reforms intended to stabilize the economy, including an end to fuel subsidies and increased electricity fees. The High Court in Abuja restricted protests to National Stadium after the city government sought a ruling. There are reports in national and international news media that police have fired tear gas at protesters outside a stadium in Abuja, in the northern city of Kano, and in other locations. There also are reports of looting in Kano, as well as counter-protests set up by government supporters. Protester Adekola Lijogi says it's his constitutional right to protest.
I don't have any group. I'm just a concerned Nigerian. I'm against it. You already have mismanaged the economy, mismanaged the value of the currency. There's hardship, there's hunger, there's deprivation. We have a list of demands which we intend to, on day three, deliver to the National Assembly, even though they are on recess.
Lijogi is optimistic that the protests will be peaceful and yield a positive result.
As long as the government does not hijack it and intervene with this their phony style of renting thugs. It's the thugs that break up shops. It's the thugs that are violent. We are genuine citizens who want to see this country change. So why are we going to make it violent?
The organizers have planned various activities over the next 10 days, all aimed at drawing attention to the economic plight of ordinary Nigerians. For VOA News, from Abuja, Nigeria.
A short time ago, authorities imposed a curfew in Kano State after the protests turned violent. The protesters set ablaze a new digital innovation facility, and in Kaduna State, there are reports of police battling with protesters. Ethiopia is easing foreign exchange curbs as part of an economic reform package as the deeply indebted nation gets a multi-billion dollar bailout from international lenders. in the second part of my conversation with Ahmed Suleiman, Senior Research Fellow, Africa Program at Chatham House. He points out there will be further inflationary pressure and says recovery package will likely be painful for the average Ethiopian.
This is where the short term is going to be likely more painful for the average citizen. Certainly when we think about kind of trying to tighten the exchange rate and, you know, essentially narrow the gap to the black market, which a lot of people have been trading and working in as well. So I think certainly it will impact everyday Ethiopians' spending power initially. What we've seen in terms of this 30% devaluation, if it holds, is very much in line with what would have been expected. So if it doesn't go any further than that, then, you know, I think that is kind of the baseline as to what would have been expected. The government has announced, but we need to see the detail really on what that means, that in order to mitigate that, there are, you know, social safety nets that they will try and minimize some of the impact on more vulnerable households. So they've announced, you know, strengthening of some social safety nets, temporary subsidies on fuel, fertilizers, medicine, certainly edible oils, you know, which has been a big issue over in terms of scarcity in a number of places and rising costs for many Ethiopians. So I think hopefully those measures can take some effect and take some of the sting off these short-term changes. The National Bank also indicated that there'll be some financial support for low-income civil servants, and obviously that's with respect to urban residents, but also the Productive Safety Net program, trying to kind of curb some of the inflationary impacts on commodities. But it's yet to be seen how this will be rolled out. And so it'd be very difficult to make any predictions on this without understanding more clearly how the government plans to roll out these measures.
And also learn what happened in Kenya.
Yeah. And I think this is part of it, right? I think this is, and what happens in Kenya, in Uganda. And I think, you know, this is certainly part of the story. And why I was saying, I think there has been a reluctance and a pushback by the federal government when it comes to devaluation of the currency. This issue has been a really thorny one, I think, because of the understanding of the unrest that Ethiopia, it's not even in past tense, is it? Is going through.
And it's ongoing.
That might work. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's ongoing, that it is going through, and that this might worsen that in some cases, particularly, you know, given some of the protests that we had previously seen, obviously related to other issues as well. But the fact that I mean, when we're talking about some of the macro figures, of course, that's one thing. But one of the key areas of difficulty for the Ethiopian government is, of course, in trying to, how do you transform what has been relatively successful economic growth, headline growth, into providing jobs for a growing population, a huge 120 million population, and a very young population, an increasingly young population. So I think growth, obviously, which we have seen since the kind of 2000s be very healthy, that we haven't seen matched by job creation. And the move to industrialization, the move to increasing the manufacturing sector, for example, hasn't really kept pace. It's not generated employment for young and rapidly growing and urbanizing population, you know, which is predominantly still agrarian.
That was Ahmed Suleiman, Senior Research Fellow, Africa Program at Chatham House. He spoke with me from London. At this time, U.S. President Joe Biden is expected to speak about a prisoner swap between Russia and Western countries. Russia, the United States, and five other countries are exchanging 26 prisoners today. Turkey says Russia freed 16 Western prisoners, including American journalist Ivan Gershkovich and former U.S. Marine Paul Whelan. Also freed was Alsu Kormesheva, a Russian-American journalist for Radio Free Europe, which is funded by the U.S. government. 10 Russians were handed over from Western countries. Turkey said it negotiated the transfer of the detainees who were flown to Ankara before traveling to their home countries. A Russian court recently sentenced Wall Street Journal journalist Gershkovich to a 16-year prison term for espionage. Whelan, who worked for a U.S. company in Russia, was arrested in 2018 on spying charges. Both men and the U.S. government have denied the charges. Kormesheva was convicted last month of spreading false information about the Russian army, as well as the three Americans, German Rico Krieger, who was imprisoned in Belarus, Russian dissident Ilya Yashin, and Russian intelligence colonel Vadim Krotsikova, who was held in Germany for the killing of a Chechen separatist, were part of the swap. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Some security experts say militants belonging to Islamic extremist groups such as Al-Qaeda and Islamic State may have undergone military instructions in South Africa under the guise of being trained as security guards. This is the loophole used by 95 alleged members of a Libyan militia arrested last Friday at a training camp run by a security company near a remote town in South Africa. Darren Taylor explains.
Former South African Army officer Neil De Beer is one of many private security experts who've warned that militias and terrorist groups are being trained in military tactics at camps in the country.
We know for a fact that they live amongst us. The current scenario of people warning, giving red flags and saying that South Africa is becoming a portal for these kinds of crimes, terror, is no more debated.
In recent years, the United States has placed sanctions on several individuals alleged to be operatives and trainers for groups including Al-Qaeda and ISIS in South Africa. Washington has described South Africa as a hub of terrorism financing and training. De Beer says the previous government, under the sole control of the African National Congress, the ANC, had, in his words, no will to change the situation. De Beer points to the experience of a former senior police administrative employee, Patricia Mashale, as evidence of this lack of political will. In 2022, Mashale approached police commanders, the State Security Agency, and top ANC members with evidence that police members were working with security companies to run secret military training camps.
April 2022, me and my husband George Mashale handed over two flash drives to the former Deputy Minister of SSA, Zizi Kodwa, regarding those illegal military training camps. We also reported it to the former National Commissioner General Sithole. He didn't want information. He wanted details of the source. That's when we told him that we will never give him the details of the sources because that's our sources. We must take them and we know what happened to the source.
The former Deputy Minister of South Africa's State Security Agency, Zizi Kodwa, and former National Police Commissioner Enoch Sithole deny receiving evidence of illegal military training camps. Mashale told VOA shortly after she spilled the beans about the camps, she was arrested on charges including spreading false information. A judge acquitted her on Tuesday. De Beer says Mashale's experience shows that many people have known for a long time about illegal military training in South Africa.
South Africa is becoming a logistical conduit to terror. The level of cartel movement, of drug shipping, of armament, of training, of cash flow is not just being said by current authority. The United States of America, who has fought terror, fought cartels and fundamentalism in every part of the globe, has recognized that there are certain individuals currently residing in this country of ours that don't just speak to terrorists, engage with terrorists, but are funding them. We better wake up, because if we don't, the absolute terror now being cast in Mozambique, the horrific deaths and killings in DRC are going to come to roost in this country.
The ANC, which led the government for 30 years, now shares power with several parties in a coalition government established after national elections in May. South Africa's new security ministries, established after the election, say they're forming specialized anti-terror units. These units, they say, will also be tasked with shutting down all facilities suspected of training potential terrorists. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The U.S. presidential contest, Republican candidate Donald Trump and likely Democratic candidate Kamala Harris are both out on the campaign trail, where Trump questioned Harris's racial identity and Harris challenged Trump to a debate. With fewer than 100 days before Election Day, VOA correspondent Scott Stearns looks at the state of the race and what voters are saying about the candidates.
Republican candidate Donald Trump told supporters in the key swing state of Pennsylvania that his likely Democratic opponent is a fraud.
The radical left Democrat party bosses have installed a puppet candidate to fight only for themselves. Kamala Harris got zero votes. She's totally scripted, owned, and controlled by the donors and the power brokers who created her campaign and who rip off our government and make billions and billions of dollars.
Earlier in the day, Trump had a contentious meeting with black journalists where he questioned the racial identity of Harris, whose mother was Indian and her father is black.
She was always of Indian heritage, and she was only promoting Indian heritage. I didn't know she was black until a number of years ago when she happened to turn black, and now she wants to be known as black. So I don't know, is she Indian or is she black?
Harris has long self-identified as both black and South Asian American. Since becoming the likely Democratic presidential candidate, she's drawn even with Trump in seven key swing states. According to political polling by Bloomberg News and The Morning Consult, largely on the strength of greater support from young, black, and Hispanic voters. Harris says it's a new presidential contest.
So the momentum in this race is shifting. And there are signs that Donald Trump is feeling it. Notice.
Harris told a rally Tuesday in Georgia that Trump seems to have a lot to say about her, but does not want to debate in September as scheduled.
Well, Donald, I do hope you'll reconsider to meet me on the debate stage. Because as the saying goes, if you've got something to say, say it to my face.
Harris is expected to announce her vice presidential pick in the coming days and still has the party's convention in Chicago to help convince voters that she's a better choice than Trump. In North Carolina, voter Wanda Cherry says she's excited about the Democratic Party switch from President Joe Biden to Harris.
I'm glad that the president realized that we need somebody younger to run the country, somebody that has the smarts and the willingness to run.
Georgia voter T. Stanley does not believe Harris is ready to be president.
First, her being the candidate, this is like horrific to me because, first of all, she's not prepared to be president, and it seems like she's already president now.
Georgia voter Phil Ownby says Harris has reinvigorated the presidential race.
I will vote for her, and I'm excited to do so. I generally think she may be a little liberal on certain issues, but in order to safeguard our democracy, I definitely vote for her.
In California, voter Marina George says Trump's support is strong enough to defeat any challenger.
Even with Kamala Harris coming in, anyone they put, they're not going to win. It's just making the Democrat Party break apart even more and faster. And everything that they're doing is good for the Republicans.
Nationally, the Bloomberg poll shows Harris and Trump in a statistical tie with fewer than 100 days to go before Election Day. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
Time now for our Olympic update. And Mokbilia Baro, our VOA sports analyst and host of our Olympics podcast, Chasing Gold, is in studio. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Mokbil.
Thanks for having me, Hayes.
So South Sudan lost to the U.S. men's Olympic team, 103-86. How did they play and what does this mean for the next game?
Yeah, so at the moment, we have the U.S. team is the only one in that group that has two wins. In the group stages, you need three wins. Not necessarily three wins. You need to be the top two teams will come out of that group. So at the moment, you have the United States with 6 points. You have both Serbia and South Sudan with 3 points. And you have Puerto Rico with 0 points because they lost both games. Now, interestingly enough, This is the beauty of the game of basketball, right? It just depends on that specific day, how you're feeling, how you play, and matchups matter as well. So South Sudan and Serbia were both able to beat Puerto Rico, but the difference by which Serbia beat Puerto Rico was a larger margin. Now, because both teams have one win and one loss, it doesn't really the points differential doesn't matter as much. So what'll matter now is that final game. They both play on Saturday. If South Sudan wins, they advance. If Serbia wins, they advance. Now, Serbia is ranked number four in the world, and South Sudan is ranked number 33rd in the world, and this is their very first Olympics. So just winning that first game against Puerto Rico is huge in and of itself. If they can pull off a victory against Serbia, and they have shown their class in exhibition games in the past against the U.S. as well. So I'm very excited to see what they do against Serbia.
And they're tied with the number three, Serbia. That's amazing.
Huge.
Only three African countries have medaled so far. Are we expecting more to come?
Absolutely. You know, as you know, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Kenya, Uganda, and the likes are very, very highly favored in the longer distance run. So we're waiting on the track and field aspect to come in play with the 800 meters, the 5,000 meters, 1,500 meters, as well as the 10,000 meters. And when those come around, we will be expecting some gold, some silver, some bronze coming through for the African continent. So exciting, exciting, exciting.
And then lastly, Flavor Flav, the rapper and co-founder of the legendary hip-hop group Public Enemy, has sponsored the U.S. women's water polo team. And it has gone a bit viral. Care to let us know what people have been saying about that?
People have just been so shocked because we've seen Flavor Flav not only in his him being a rapper, a hip hop head. He's a reality star at one point. He had a show called Flavor of Love. So people are very familiar with him. Now to see him now take on that sponsorship of the water polo team, the women's water polo team, highlights that team and a sport that maybe doesn't get as much recognition yearly. To see them in the Olympics has been amazing. So maybe some other big time stars like that might start sponsoring lesser known sports.
Mokbilia Baro, our VOA sports analyst, thank you for your input.
Thanks for having me.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. And on behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Shogun Chung, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.